Welcome back. I just want to dive back into our conversation with Marianne, so I'll keep this brief. You're listening to the Montana Minute, and if you didn't listen to the first half of this feature on loss and grief, go back and give it a listen. In it, we learned that grief is really a complex issue, so I thought it best to set it apart so we could gain a good understanding before diving into how to apply all of this information, which you'll get in this half. So now let's pick up right where we left off to get some advice from Marianne on how to help children and families experiencing grief.
Let's talk about a child who has maybe been removed from their household and has lost a parent in that sense.
Yeah.
I think sometimes I tend to think of grief in this box of death.
Yeah.
But you could have a loss by just simply being removed from the house.
And that is such a huge loss. And that loss, perhaps even more than most losses, represents multiple losses. So if you think about it, if a child is removed from the parent, they haven't just lost the parent. They have lost everything that is normal to them. That's a child I would worry about, actually, as a grief person. That's a child who has been plucked out of what is normal and put into a strange environment with a broken heart. That's rough. And I would be very concerned about that child. That is a child whose grief is going to be difficult to express because they don't have trusted people that they can express it to. That's a child who may freeze and just shut down. And so, again, it can be really easy to look at a child who's shut down and think, oh, they're fine. Or that's a child who's going to act out because that's how children express. And it would be really tempting to say, oh, this is a child who doesn't behave when their heart is broken and they don't know what's up. So that is an absolute setup for not only grief, but grief compounded in so many ways, because one of the best ways to handle grief is within your social environment. Well, it's all new. So how is that going to happen?
And that's what really struck me about what you've just said is they don't have a trusted figure to go to and process the grief.
And so then the question is, like, what do you do about that? Because sometimes children have to be removed from their loved one. The best thing is for them to be able to go to somebody that they already know. That if there's a kinship placement, that's optimal if that can happen, because at least then maybe they could have 20% of normal, you know. But if they can't and they have to go to strangers, and well-intentioned, wonderful strangers with a loving heart, they're still strangers. And everything is still different. And so what I would say, if I was advising a family who took in a child who was separated from a parent, is please make as much the same for this child as can be, even if that's hard for you. If this child is used to eating strawberry Pop-Tarts for breakfast, then for heaven's sake, buy the strawberry Pop-Tarts. This is not the time to insist on healthy food. Right? If the child is used to sleeping in the same room with her sister, by all means, put her in the same room with the sister. Try to keep the school the same, the friends the same, like as much the same as possible. I worry about kids who are pulled from their parents who then are pulled from their pets. That's another big loss. And if there's a way that there can be visitation of pets, visitation of parents, visitation of friends, anything that can help maintain those connections would be really important. But for me, what I see as absolutely critical, and when I've counseled with families who have lost one of the parents or both parents, which unfortunately I have, is that routine matters to children. You must keep everything as much the same as possible. So I would ask that kid, what kind of toothpaste does your family use? And then I would go get it. What color is your toothbrush? Okay, blue. We'll go find you a blue toothbrush. Like that kind of thing. And again, you know, yeah, if a child came into my home and said, we're going to eat strawberry Pop-Tarts, I would be pretty appalled. However, again, you have to think about what is most important here, the welfare of a child. You can deal with the diet later. Pop-Tarts are fine. So it's that kind of, those kind of small things that can make a really big difference.
I imagine there's so many foster parents who have the best intentions.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, why would you do this
unless
you had a heart of gold?
Yeah.
And wonder, you know, why is this child acting out? We're giving them a healthy diet. We are giving them so many things that they never had before.
Right.
But what you're saying is the key word there is they never,
never
had,
had it before. Exactly.
Right.
And so what you've done is you've caused them to have loss of their normal breakfast, their loss of their dog, the loss of their everything. Like everything, you know, you don't let them watch the TV shows, loss of the TV shows. And so, yeah, okay, get it that those are, maybe there are unhealthy things going on. But if they're not dangerously unhealthy in the short term, just go with it. Mm-hmm. Get the strawberry Pop-Tarts. It's going to be fine.
So let's add another layer on top of this. What if the final plan at the end of the day is to reunite these children with their parents?
Isn't that wonderful when that happens? Because that means parents have done their work and they love those children. All those parents love their children. And so then the child gets to go back to the parent and develop a new normal. I think one positive thing that could be said for being in a foster placement is that if the foster parent does this well, and if it's true, you can continually offer that child hope. And that hope is really powerful. So the child, yes, you have to, you know, you have to live here, and no, it's not the same school, and I'm sorry about that. But, you know, it sounds like your mom or dad is working really hard, and I'm just really hopeful that you'll be able to be back again, and then you'll be back at your old school. And so I would not offer false hope, but I would absolutely, if the hope is realistic, then I would keep that as a beacon out for that child too. I think that would help a lot with the loss and the grief. The other things I would say to a foster parent who was working with a child, obviously if in a foster family, they've been removed from their parents, two other things is to think of the child like a saturated sponge. There is not room for one more drop. And when the one more drop goes in, it's going to be a big mess. And just expect that. Like those outbursts, those just meltdowns reflects the fact that the saturated sponge got overloaded and it just can't take anymore. And so having those lower expectations, just recognizing, I like to think of it like this too. It's like we start every day with 100 little soldiers to do the business of our life. And when you have to pick up laundry, maybe that takes 5. And then you've got to make dinner. And oh my gosh, I have to go to an emergency meeting. That takes 20 little soldiers. And when you're grieving, 90 of them are on grief detail. You don't have 100 to do the business of the life. And yet you're used to it. So that's why you must dial back. And we have to understand that with kids. They have 10 little soldiers to do the work of 100. So they cannot do the things they're normally doing, whether that's being polite, whether that's going to bed when you're supposed to, whether that's getting along with people. Like those take little soldiers when you're 8 years old. And they don't have enough to do all that.
Remembering to do your homework.
Exactly. You know? Or just doing your homework. It's like when they say, I just can't, whether it's with words or actions, it's because they can't. They literally do not have the inner resources to do it. And I think when people understand that, then there's a compassion that just makes it so much easier. And, you know, that goes along with the other thing I wanted to say is that you have to have patience for these little people. Just have to have patience. So important.
Do you have any other advice or pieces of wisdom or knowledge that...
Yeah. One thing I want to make sure and say is that, and I teach a death and dying class here at the University of Montana a couple times a year, and I always ask people, what do they already know about grief? And it is shocking to me how many people believe that there are stages to grief. And it's because that became part of our popular culture in the 60s and 70s, and it has just stuck.
Stuck in the lexicon.
It is. For sure. And if people remember nothing else about this, please toss that out the window. And I'll tell you why. When Elizabeth Kubler-Ross did that, first of all, she was studying dying people, not grieving people. And even she, at the end of her life, backed off from those stages, but they somehow stuck. And so what happens is, and this is a real life example, someone came in to see me and like, I thought I was doing okay. The child had died. I thought I was doing okay. But now I find myself back in the anger stage again. So I'm obviously not. And that was one of the most humbling experiences of my life. I realized, oh, because of what we have told people to expect from grief, this poor woman has not only lost her son, but she thinks she can't even grieve properly. So what stages does is set people up to think it's going to be a certain way, and it never is. And so then they think they're also doing it wrong. That's really unkind. One of the things I think is really important as we talk about grief and loss is there are no stages. It is, think of grief as chaos, and that the job of grief is to reorder the chaos and find the new normal. I also remember a mom whose daughter died, and she said to me, I will never get to acceptance because it will never be acceptable that my child died. You don't have to accept it. It's okay that you don't accept it. That doesn't mean you don't go on to live a wonderful life, always missing that child, but having a wonderful, happy life.
That's so helpful to hear. Grief is chaos, you know? And I think a lot of people in chaos look for, you know, just give me the list. Let me right. check off those boxes.
Yes.
And that those stages of grief just fit nicely into that human need to
yes.
have order.
Have order.
Yeah.
And the fact is it's not orderly. It's a big, giant, emotional, everything mess. And that's okay. That's how it's supposed to be. And it will gradually get better. It will get better. So the other things that can help kids, I talked about routine. I think that's super important. Change as little as possible. The other thing that I think is important is to educate kids about what's normal. Like, yeah, of course you're sad. Like, normalize it. Educate. Of course. If you had to move away from your cat and your blanket, and of course you're going to be sad, and of course you're going to cry. That's okay. And so educating, to me, is one of the most helpful grief interventions, because if people know what's normal, even children, they can put up with a lot. And it can even be helpful if you're working with a child and someone in the family has died, to tell them, what I tell children is, the grown-ups are going to cry a million tears. And it is going to be so annoying, I know, but they have to cry the million tears. So until they've cried the million tears, you know, they just have to keep crying. And your job, you have an important job, I tell children in this family, and that is to find the nearest box of Kleenex and give it to the crying adult. And I even tell families in advance, like if they know a death is coming or they've asked me, what can we do? I say, have someone take that child to the store and pick out 6 or 7 boxes of Kleenex of their own choice. So yes, that might be Mickey Mouse. But put those boxes of Kleenex all over the house and tell the child, someone's crying, go grab a Kleenex box. And that, okay, I think I probably thought of it as just this whimsical thing to do, but I cannot tell you how many people have told me how helpful that has been. Because it gives the child, like, oh, I know what to do now. I go get the Kleenex. So thinking in terms of giving the child information that, yes, there is going to be crying in it. Yes, there's a lot of crying. The crying is the thing that bothers the kids the most. So letting the kids know about that and giving them a job, super important. I think it's also really important to not judge children's grief, but to understand that it is normal that they grieve in pieces, that their grief looks different, that their grief is expressed in play, not to get too freaked out when the kids are having funerals all the time, or, you know, that's just normal. And that to to get away from the idea that there's closure. Grief is not a problem to be fixed. It's just a thing to be experienced. And if you understand that, and if you're patient, and kids can survive a lot of things. So knowledge, education, normalize it. Other things, that real tangible things that people can do that have been helpful to other families. If it's been a death, it can be very helpful to set aside time every week to do something in memorial. Light a candle, do a scrapbook, capture a favorite memory, make the same food that the person loved, go out to the favorite pizza parlor, something that kind of lets everybody rest their mind on the person and the grief in that moment.
That really speaks to me about the spiritual part, whether that's through an organized religious faith or what you do with your family in a spiritual sense to create the ritual, the remembrance, the honoring. Seems very important to
Absolutely. And I raised three children whose mother died. And one thing we did with them is at the funeral, we asked everybody to write letters to the boys about their mom and what they remember about her, because they would never know her as an adult. And those letters we have in a book, and that's a treasure. You know, it's a way to help that child remember someone that in a way that they wouldn't have had the chance to do it. And so that brings me to my other point, which is help children capture memories. So I've had kids that I worked with 15 years ago get in touch with me. I have things they wrote. I have things on my computer that they told me stories about their favorite thing that they did with their dad. They didn't remember. But because I wrote it down, I was able to give it to them. And you can give it to the families. Like when I do grief groups, it's one of the things we do the most is capture those memories. And then they take them home and they have them for the rest of their life. So that's something else that families can do is to work on memory making. Because sad as it is, you know, if a six-year-old loses a parent or a sibling, they won't remember very much unless we help them. So I think that's really important to do.
Yeah, I like the intersection of, you know, you saying grief is not a problem to be solved. Mm-hmm. I think if you have the mindset, just get over it and you need to find some closure, why would you capture? You know, why would you capture those memories and give them to the child in a way that they could remember? You wouldn't want them to come back to the grief, but it's important to recognize this is a process for them that doesn't get a nice, neat cap on it.
It doesn't. You know, the adult will grieve their mother also, and it's such a blessing for them to be able to read those letters and or to see those pictures or all of those things, to read their own memories from when they were a child of their mother. So schedule times for grief, give kids breaks from grief, help them capture their memories, educate them about grief, routine. I cannot emphasize that enough. When kids have grief experiences, we're educating them for their lifetime about grief and loss. And so it's not just important for right now, but it's important for their whole life. So if we minimize it, if we teach them to stuff it, we're teaching them that's how you handle grief and loss in your lifetime. But if we teach them about coping strategies and about what is normal and how to lower your expectations when you've had a big emotional hit, those are lifelong lessons as well. And those lifelong lessons can happen even if it's a loss that doesn't seem grief-worthy to us. And I think that's a really important term. A child may grieve something that we don't think is important, but if it's important to a child, it's an opportunity to teach really, really valuable lessons about grief. Specifically, I'm talking about pets. Pets are often the first losses that children have, and we need to be very careful about how we handle those.
You're not going to get away from grief.
No.
And so the earlier you learn about how to work with it and understand it, the better off you are.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because after the pet, it's most likely a grandparent.
Right? Exactly. Grandparents and pets are the ones. And so, in fact, I have a book chapter coming out, and it's all about what the family dog can teach children about end of life, loss, and grief. And that was a really interesting process to be engaged with, thinking about what messages do we give our children when their dog dies. You know, if you think about it, so many families euthanize their dog. You know, that's an option for an animal. But we tell children that it's because the dog was suffering. Those children will become teenagers, and they will suffer. And they will suffer in ways that to them feel really bad. And I worry about setting children up to think that suffering is like a reason not to live. Everybody suffers. Everybody has grief. Everybody has pain. And so I think we have to be really careful about the language we use around loss, around grief. And I think we have to be really careful to honor another person's grief experience, even when we don't understand the loss, because we want to raise empathic, compassionate children. And when we reach out to a child and say, I am really sorry that your goldfish died, and you know, let's go plant some forget-me-nots for your goldfish. 10 years later, that child will be able to do that to a friend, to someone else. And I think those are really valuable lessons. So I think, I mean, this topic, you cannot get away from loss and you can't get away from grief. And when we learn to do it better, then we help other people, and we also, I think, help ourselves when we find ourselves in that really dark place. And when you teach it to a child, you spread it out. Like, they're going to go, and they're going to do it well in their lifetime, and they're going to offer compassion to people.
That's a great, incredible way to end our conversation, I think.
Well, thank you.
Good advice. So thank you again. It sounds like you've helped countless people go through the grieving process.
And, well.
Or, you know, been present for
present.
Them.
Present. I have been
helped
present.
Them do the work.
I have been a witness and a companion.
Well, thank you for that.
That's what I would say. Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And thank you for talking with
yeah,
me.
Yeah. Thank you very much for doing this.
As Marianne and I were wrapping up our conversation, one thing we talked about was something I also have some personal experience with. And if you're just a professional wondering how to help, she told me, don't give advice and don't offer platitudes that everything will be all right. The best thing you can do is just sit there, be present, and listen. There's this strong urge as a helping professional to just fix other people's problems by saying the right thing. But you just need to realize that it's not about saying the right thing or doing the right thing. Marianne said, once I realized I couldn't fix it, I actually became helpful. That's, to me, such a valuable piece of advice. You can't fix it, but you can stay present. That saying that you don't have to be alone in your grief, in your agony, I'm willing to sit with you through that. And it's a gift to a grieving person. So that's it for our episode on grief and loss. I hope you can walk away from this saying you've learned something, and I hope you'll come and join us again next time. This has been the Montana Minute. I'm Zach Reamer. Thanks, as always, to Ira Wolf for the great music, and to all of you listening out there, I hope you take care of yourself, and I'll see you next time.